Today, the absolute link between home prices and credit. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Back in March, in my post, Popping the Housing Affordability Myth, I showed that contrary to popular belief, home price growth is most strongly correlated to credit availability. When we rolled all the possible factors into our scenario models and examined the relative influence of each on home prices, we found that the four most powerful levers in terms of home price movement is first, personal credit growth, including mortgages and other loans, at 27% of total impact. Investment lending contributed a further 18%, followed by tax policy for investment property at 17%, and the cash rate at 14%. The other factors, which are the ones which are spoken about the most, property supply, population growth, planning restrictions, and migration, together make up just 22% of total impact. Or in other words, without addressing the credit elephant in the room, tax policy and interest rates, the chances of taming prices is low. First-time buyer incentives were less than 1%. Now, the so-called classic economic theory is that supply and demand of property drives prices. So factors such as the number of builds, population and migration, plus planning controls, are all to blame. Indeed, a recent paper from the RBA peddled the line, as does the property and real estate sector. And state and federal governments also talk this up. But our analysis showed that you can forget migration, construction of new homes, or even foreign investment. Availability of credit drives prices, period. But this is contentious because classic economists, including most of those residing in central banks, tend to argue that credit growth is a zero-sum game, in that if there is a loan on one side of the ledger, then there is a creditor on the other side of the fence, so the net impact is zero. Credit growth then is just fine. Yet, back in 2014, I discussed this based on an insight from the Bank of England Quarterly Bulletin, which was revolutionary and still has the potential to rewrite economics. Their paper, entitled Money Creation in the Modern Economy, turns things on their head. Because rather than the normal assumption that money starts with deposits to banks, who lend them on at a turn, they argue that money is created mainly by commercial banks making loans. The demand for deposits follows. So rather than banks receiving deposits when households save and then lending them out, bank lending creates deposits. And more recently, the Bank of Norway confirmed this and said, the bank does not transfer the money from someone else's bank account or from a vault full of money. The money lent to you by the bank has been created by the bank itself out of nothing. Fiat let it become. And even the arch-conservative German Bundesbank said in 2017, this means that banks can create book money just by making an accounting entry. According to the Bundesbank's economists, this refutes a popular misconception that banks act simply as intermediaries at the time of lending, i.e. that banks can only grant credit using funds placed with them previously as deposits by other customers. Therefore, the only limit on the amount of credit is people's ability to service the loans eventually. The more banks lend, the bigger they can become without limit. Of course, in the scenario where credit is being tightened, as we discussed yesterday in the context of the recent Westpac home loan questions, home prices are going to fall. And the tighter credit is, the further they will fall. And now others are catching on. Tim Lawless over at CoreLogic posted some of their research on this very topic. He showed that since 2015, the correlation between dwelling value appreciation and housing credit has become ever tighter, especially when measured against investment credit. Since macroprudential measures were announced and implemented by APRA, the trends in housing-related credit have changed remarkably. Soon after APRA announced the 10% annual speed limit for investment lending in December 2014, investment housing finance commitments peaked at 55% of mortgage demand, and investment credit growth moved through a cyclical peak rate of annual growth at 10.8%. Around the same time, the quarterly rate of home value appreciation peaked in Sydney and Melbourne, the two cities where investment has been most concentrated. as credit policies were tightened in response to the APRA limits, then loosened as lenders overachieved their APRA targets, the housing market responded virtually in concert. And then interest rate cuts in May and August of 2016 helped to support a rebound in the pace of capital gains. However, as lenders came close to breaching the 10% limit, at least on a monthly annualized basis, credit once again tightened, and the second round of macroprudential announced in March 2017 saw credit availability restricted further. The result of changes in credit availability has become evident across most housing markets, but is very clear in Sydney and Melbourne. Dwelling values started to track lower in Sydney from July last year and peaked in Melbourne in November last year. More recently, Lawless says, there are some early signs that Sydney's housing market is already achieving a soft landing, probably earlier than expected, and the monthly rate of decline has eased from 0.9% in December and January to reach 0.6% in February and 0.3% in March. The easing rate of decline comes as investment credit flows have ticked up a notch, and some lenders have announced a reduction in the mortgage rate premiums being paid by investors and interest-only borrowers. Whether the improvement in Sydney's housing market is temporary or not will be largely dependent on credit policies. And it's hard to imagine any lender would be aggressively ramping up their share of investment loans despite the fact that APRA benchmarks have been so comprehensively achieved. Investment credit growth is currently tracking at just 2.8% per annum, and interest-only originations are tracking at around 15% in December last year, roughly half the 30% APRA benchmark. Despite overshooting the benchmarks, considering the Royal Commission is underway and there is a great deal of focus on lending practices, the likelihood is that investment-related credit may step up a notch, but not likely enough to cause a sharp rebound in housing market conditions like those we saw through 2016. Now, I would add that based on our discussions from yesterday, credit is set to get a lot tighter, which is why I'm still running a base case scenario of a fall around 20% in home prices in Sydney in 2019. And interestingly, SQM Research just published some downward revisions of their price expectations. Previously, they had been much more bullish. Here is their latest data, with downward revisions in Brisbane, Darwin, Melbourne, Sydney and Canberra, though unchanged in Perth, Adelaide and Hobart. They also state that they think Sydney prices are overvalued by around 40% and that in 2019 more falls are likely. Of course, forward estimates of future prices are always going to be wrong. There are too many variables to drive the analysis for a simple result, and there is no one correlation. But credit growth clearly drives home prices, and investor lending is the stronger variable in terms of volumes. So the leading indicator of future home prices is investor lending. And to be clear, despite APRA's recent removal of the 10% speed limit, our surveys are showing lower demand from investors as credit availability is tightened and home prices slide. And these forces are mutually reinforcing and on the downside. If you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. And I want to say thanks to those who have already subscribed. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Thank you.